From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Captain Iglesias, the U.S. prosecutor, knew something was very wrong when, just a week before the 2006 midterm elections, he received a strange and threatening call to his home.
They wanted a political operative who happened to be a U.S. attorney, and when they got somebody who actually took his oath to the Constitution seriously, they were appalled.
Ousted New Mexico prosecutor David Iglesias is at the center of the U.S. attorney firing scandal. We'll get a special report from investigative journalist Greg Palast, then a conversation with two leading feminists. Iraqi Yanar Mohammed will discuss the Talibanization of Iraq. Dr. Seema Samar is the former deputy prime minister in Afghanistan. She was nearly prevented from entering the United States this weekend. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 120 people were killed in Iraq Sunday, in one of the deadliest days in weeks. 50 people died and more than 100 were wounded in a suicide attack in the northern Kurdish town of Makmur. It was the second attack to hit Iraq's Kurdish region in 5 days. As the violence escalates, Iraq's Interior Ministry has announced a ban on news photographers and camera crews from the scene of bombing attacks. Iraqi officials say the measure is meant to protect evidence, hide victims, and deny attackers information they achieve their goals. The Iraqi government has already come under wide criticism for a series of limits on news coverage inside Iraq. In other Iraq news, U.S. forces have launched a search for three soldiers missing following an attack that killed four other troops and an Iraqi interpreter. An al-Qaeda-linked group has claimed responsibilities and says it's holding the troops captive. It was one of the deadliest operations against U.S. forces since the three-month-old crackdown on Baghdad. This is U.S. spokesperson Major General William Caldwell.
We have an ongoing effort, obviously, to find our three soldiers that have a duty status of whereabouts unknown. That's continuing. We've got about 4,000 U.S. forces that have been directly associated now with this ongoing effort. And in addition to the forces, and probably more importantly, are the additional assets in terms of aerial assets and intelligence assets that have been redirected and are focused in there, again, trying to help us find our three missing soldiers.
And in other news from Iraq, Iraq's parliament has approved a measure calling for an end to the building of massive security walls around Baghdad neighborhoods. The walls have drawn protests across sectarian lines as evidence of a U.S.-backed strategy of divide and rule. Vice President Dick Cheney has issued a new warning to Iran. Speaking aboard a U.S. aircraft carrier off the United Arab Emirates, Cheney said the U.S. military presence in the Gulf region should send a strong message. Cheney, just one day before the U.S. and Iran announced plans to meet in Baghdad in the next few weeks. The talks would mark the highest level publicly acknowledged contact between the two sides in years. In Pakistan, at least 41 people have died in clashes in the city of Karachi. The fighting was set off following the suspension of a top judge by the government of President Pervez Musharraf. In Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair is set to be questioned in Parliament this week over his talks with President Bush about bombing the Arabic television network Al Jazeera. Two men were convicted last week for leaking a record of a conversation in which President Bush reportedly says he wants to bomb the network's Doha headquarters. In the occupied territories, the Palestinian Interior Minister has resigned amidst a new outbreak of factional violence. Two people have been killed and 10 wounded in clashes between Fatah and Hamas members. Meanwhile, a pregnant Palestinian woman lost her unborn baby Thursday after coming under fire from Israeli troops in Nablus. Israel says it was responding to shooting from Palestinian militants. Maham Khatoumi was in her 8th month of pregnancy. This is her husband, Jihad.
When the shooting started, my wife went to bring the children from the other room. As she stood up, the bullets entered her body. She was thrown from the bed to the bathroom. This is what happened.
Meanwhile, a new study from two Israeli human rights groups shows Palestinians have abandoned more than 1,000 homes and nearly 2,000 businesses in the West Bank town of Hebron. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel and B'Tselem attribute most of the flights to pressure and violence from Israeli soldiers and settlers. Most residents have fled since the outbreak of the second Palestinian Intifada nearly 7 years ago. The Bush administration has withdrawn one of its proposals to restrict attorney access for prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. The Justice Department says it will no longer seek to limit attorneys to just 3 visits with their clients, but it wants to keep rules that would allow just 1 visit per prospective lawyers, deny attorneys access to secret evidence, and allow military officials to read attorney-client mail. Meanwhile, a U.S. Navy attorney goes on trial today for allegedly leaking the names of the prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay. Lieutenant Commander Matthew Diaz is accused of passing on secret national defense information to a lawyer with the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights. He faces more than 36 years in prison. In Texas, voters in the Dallas suburb of Farmers Branch have approved a measure barring renting homes to most undocumented immigrants. Landlords would be forced to check if renters are U.S. citizens or visa-approved immigrants before giving them a lease. Opponents plan to challenge the measure in court. Virginia Tech held graduation ceremonies Friday, less than a month after the mass shooting that killed 32 people. 27 of the victims were honored with degrees.
Today, we honor all graduate students who have earned graduate degrees. Some are here with us in person. Some will attend the commencement ceremonies in the National Capital Region on Sunday. Some, due to personal and professional reasons, will await the delivery of their diploma, and some are here in spirit. They are here in spirit only, but they are represented, well represented, by family, friends, and colleagues.
In environmental news, The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration is trying to weaken a climate change declaration planned for next month's gathering of world leaders at the G8 summit. U.S. negotiators are trying to delete a pledge to limit the global temperature rise and cut emissions of greenhouse gas to half 1990 levels. The administration also wants to strike language that designates the U.N. as the appropriate forum for negotiating action on climate change. And finally, in an update to a story from Friday's broadcast, students at Harvard University have ended their 9-day hunger strike as part of a campaign to demand a pay raise and improve working conditions for campus security guards. The students want the university to intervene in salary negotiations between the guards and their employer, Allied Barton. The fast ended after guards urged the students to eat. At a gathering in Harvard Yard Saturday, security guard Paul Kane thanked the students for their campaign.
For most of my coworkers, no one has ever bothered to stand up for them. No one has ever showed them the outpouring of support that we have received. And your willingness to do that means so much to us. You have been an inspiration to us. You have taught us what can happen when a community stands together. We have developed a bond that I hope will only strengthen over time. For the first time in a long while, my coworkers and I can see a light at the end of the tunnel. Thank you so very much for showing us the way.
2 students were hospitalized this week for low levels of sodium. This is student Kelly Lee.
For me, this has never just been about the hunger strike. It's never been about the students. I mean, the students who are doing the hunger strike. It's always been about the people who work here, who go home every day, who have families to take care of, who are living week to week, who need this in order to live, and who deserve this.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn to the latest now in the U.S. attorney firing scandal. Nearly half of the U.S. attorneys slated for removal by the Bush administration last year were targeted for not doing enough to prosecute voter fraud. According to the Washington Post, of the 12 U.S. attorneys known to have been dismissed or considered for removal last year, 5 were identified by presidential adviser Karl Rove or other administration officials as working in districts that were trouble spots for voter fraud: Kansas City, Milwaukee, New Mexico, Nevada, and Washington State. 4 of the 5 prosecutors in those districts were fired. Perhaps the most well-known of these U.S. attorneys is ousted New Mexico prosecutor David Iglesias. His case has been at the center of the political firestorm. Investigative journalist Greg Pallast has been closely following this story. He files this report.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask for a recess.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
The court will wait for an answer.
This past December 7th was not the first time United States prosecutor David Iglesias had been brutally cut loose.
Object! And when it went bad, you cut these guys loose!
In the 1992 film, A Few Good Men, Tom Cruise plays David Iglesias, the true story of the young military defense lawyer fighting to uncover the truth.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Greg Pallast.
Greg, hi, David Iglesias.
Hey, how are you, Captain?
Hey, I'm doing just fine, thank you.
So, can you handle the truth or not?
Absolutely.
Captain Iglesias, the U.S. prosecutor, knew something was very wrong when, just a week before the 2006 midterm elections, he received a strange and threatening call to his home. It was his state's senior senator, the powerful Republican leader Pete Domenici, on the line, pushing Iglesias to file criminal charges against a Democrat before the election.
Sitting in my bedroom, and here's the killer point, Greg. He says, are these going to get filed before November? And I said, I didn't think so, and the line goes dead. In other words, our senior senator hung up on me. A terribly inappropriate call.
Inappropriate, certainly. Obstruction of justice, possibly.
He basically wanted to know, are you going to file these cases that can help Heather out? That was the subtext. I felt terrible after that phone call.
By helping Heather, he meant Congresswoman Heather Wilson, then candidate Heather Wilson. The race was a dead heat. Domenici wanted him to bust a Democrat to help Wilson. Still, Iglesias tried to be the loyal party man, even covering up the threatening call.
Did you report this phone call to anyone at the time?
I did not, and I should have. There's a requirement under the U.S. Attorney's Manual for us to report that kind of contact from a member of Congress. I didn't do that.
But that act of loyalty wasn't good enough for Karl Rove, the president's political advisor. Rove flew to New Mexico just before the election and got an earful of complaints about Iglesias from state party chiefs. Rove reported to President Bush, who personally put the heat on Attorney General Gonzalez. Iglesias was stunned.
I had no idea that a few local yokels in New Mexico would have enough stroke to get the president to complain.
There was more than failing to help the Wilson campaign. In the 2004 presidential election, Republican operatives blocked a 250,000 new voters nationwide from voting on grounds they brought the wrong IDs to the polls. To justify this massive blockade, Republican officials wanted Iglesias to arrest some voters to create a high publicity show trial. Iglesias went along with the game. Just before the 2004 election, he held a press conference announcing the creation of a vote fraud task force. But the prosecutor drew the line at arresting innocent voters.
They were telling Rove that I wasn't doing their bidding. I wasn't filing these voter fraud cases.
The evidence fellow Republicans gave him was junk. He refused to bring a single prosecution.
It was the old throwing pasta at the wall trick. That if you throw enough pasta, something's got to stick, and it didn't.
For failing to bring the voting cases, Iglesias paid with his job.
They wanted a political operative who happened to be a U.S. attorney, and when they got somebody who actually took his oath to the Constitution seriously, they were appalled, and they wanted me out of there. The two strikes against me was I was not political. I didn't help them out on their bogus voter fraud prosecutions.
Rove personally ordered his removal. As a prosecutor, Iglesias says that if missing emails prove the firing was punishment for failure to bring bogus charges, Mr. Rove himself is in legal trouble.
If his intent was, look, we're unhappy with Iglesias, if that was his intent, he's in big trouble. That is obstruction of justice. Well, what classic example?
Iglesias believes the real reasons for the firings are in what are called the missing emails, emails sent by the Rove team using Republican Party campaign computers, which Rove claims can't be retrieved.
But not all the missing emails are missing. We have 500 of them. Apparently, the Rove team misaddressed their emails, and late one night, they all ended up in our inboxes in our offices in New York City.
And as Iglesias predicted, they reveal a story the party would rather keep buried. Voting rights attorney Robert F. Kennedy Jr. reviewed the evidence in our cache of emails and concluded,
they ought to be in jail for doing this because they knew it was illegal and they did it anyway.
What is it that was so obviously illegal that law professor Kennedy thought they deserved prison time? The evidence that shook him was attached to 50 of the secret emails, something the GOP party chiefs called caging lists. Thousands of names of voters, notably the majority, were African American. Kennedy explained how caging worked.
Caging is an illegal way of getting rid of black votes. You get a list of all the black voters, then you send a letter to their homes. And if the person doesn't sign it at the homes, the letter then is returned to the Republican National Committee. They then direct the state attorney general, who's friendly to them, who's Republican, to remove that voter from the list on the alleged basis that that voter does not live in the address that they designated as their address on the voting application form.
In all, the Republican Party challenged nearly 3 million voters, a mass attack on minority voting rights virtually unreported in the U.S. press.
So they disenfranchise millions of black voters who don't even know that they've been disenfranchised.
Page after page of voters with this address, Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, hundreds, thousands of soldiers and sailors targeted to lose their vote. Go to Baghdad, lose your vote. And what does this have to do with the prosecutor firings? Take a look at the name at the top of the secret missing email. Tim Griffin. This is the man in charge of the allegedly illegal caging operation. He's research director for the Republican National Committee, special assistant to Karl Rove. And as of December 7th, Karl Rove's personal pick for U.S. attorney for the state of Arkansas. Is this a case of the perpetrator becomes the prosecutor? For Democracy Now!, this is Greg Palast.
We use words like honor, code, loyalty.
Is Tom Cruise going to play you in this follow-up?
He's more handsome, but I'm quite a bit taller, so I've got that on.
And that was that excerpt of A Few Good Men from Greg Palast's piece. Greg Palast, investigative journalist, his latest book just out in paperback called Our Madhouse from Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of White House Gone Wild. Greg Palast joins us in the studio now. Greg, I just want to start where you left off and started this film, A Few
Right.
Good Men. I don't think most people understand this about David Iglesias.
Yes, well, Iglesias was the guy played by Tom Cruise in the film A Few Good Men, which is a real story about how a young military attorney would, you know, stood up to the military brass to uncover the truth. And somehow they thought that this, you know, that this Tom...
was the hazing of a young man, a soldier who was killed.
And it was covered up. And, you know, he just wanted to get to the truth. That was David Iglesias. Now here he is again, you know, standing up to the brass. I mean, one of the things we have to be very careful of is, you know, I'm not going to say he's a man for all season. He went along just before the 2004 election and held a big splashy press conference saying, yes, I'm going to go and look for voter fraud, that there are looks like there may be thousands of fraudulent voters. This was, understand what this is about. This is to create a hysteria so they could pass legislation which would require voters to show up with ID. 250,000 voters were turned away for having the wrong ID, but no one was arrested. So Karl Rove and his assistant, Tim Griffin, are in a panic. You're turning away thousands of voters, you're not arresting any. So he's asking Iglesias, demanding Iglesias, and now we know a half dozen others, almost everyone that was fired. They demand that they just grab people. That's where Iglesias drew the line in the sand. He said a press conference is one thing, which he probably shouldn't have done. But literally handcuffing innocent voters for show trials, and then, of course, they didn't drop the case later, that is one thing he absolutely was not going to do. He was going to give up his job. He also made the mistake. When he got calls from Senator Pete Domenici asking for inside information, pushing him to arrest Democrats a week before the midterm election of 2006. That was another attempt at what could be obstruction of justice. The U.S. code for U.S. attorneys requires that he turn in Senator Domenici, which he admits he didn't do, and now he regrets that, but he said, you know, I want the evidence out there anyway, even if it shows that I failed to act.
And Heather Wilson, of course, also called. And Heather Wilson at the time in an extremely close race for her political life as a Congress member from New Mexico.
Well, in fact, from my investigation, she didn't win. There was voter fraud, and that the majority of the votes went to the Democrats. Another thing is that Iglesias did not, unfortunately, investigate the other side of the coin, which is this massive denial of votes, systematic by the Republican, by Republican operatives. Now, what we have and what we showed in the film is that when I was investigating for BBC and for Democracy Now! Back in 2004, we got 500 of the so-called missing emails of Karl Rove. They were, you know, Karl Rove, people think he's an evil genius, but that's only about half right. I mean, he's not the necessarily the sharpest knife in the drawer, and he and his guys were mistyping their email addresses, sent them to georgewbush.org instead of .com, which is an email domain owned by friends of ours who shot them right to us. We went through the 500, and what we found were this massive plan to deny the right to vote, I mean, extraordinarily targeting African-American soldiers sent overseas. They'd send them a letter to their home address, and the letter would come back. They say, gee, they don't live there. They shouldn't be allowed to vote. Their absentee ballot would come in from overseas and it'd be challenged. They'd lose their vote. They wouldn't even know it. Now, when we showed this to several voting rights attorneys, including, as you heard, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., now he was really shaken up. That's when he said, these guys should be in jail. So this is the other side of this whole issue involving the prosecutors. And who did this? Who was in charge of this? It wasn't Rove personally. He'd put Tim Griffin in charge. Griffin is the guy who, with Rove, picked out the U.S. attorneys to be fired and then had himself named by Rove, had himself named by Rove to the spot as U.S. attorney for Arkansas. So what we may have here is a case of the perpetrator of voter fraud becoming the prosecutor. I mean, it is, and what this is all about, in fact, I have an internal Tim Griffin email. What this is all about is, he says, it's all about the votes. This is about the 2008 election, a panic to get their people in place for 2008 to create hysteria about voter ID, knock out minority voters, especially Hispanics, and to put in their people who are experienced in knocking out voters.
I want to go more into this after break. We're talking to Greg Palast's book just came out in paperback. It's called Our Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans. Stay with us.
Be your best friend, help you the way you can. Man, take a street trip, just run the way. Careful how you vote on election day. Not the one that you go for. God knows he might know stuff. All right, Eddie.
Careful how you vote, Sonny Landslim. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Greg Palast, investigative journalist, author of Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans. Investigative journalist Murray Wass reported last week the Bush administration has withheld emails showing senior White House and Justice Department officials collaborated to conceal the role of White House strategist Karl Rove in installing his former deputy, Timothy Griffin, as U.S. attorney in Arkansas. The email showed that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's former chief of staff, Decal Sampson, worked with White House officials on two letters that misled Congress on the appointment and also Rove's role in that. Greg.
Well, yeah, they were covering up the fact that Tim Griffin, who is Rove's right-hand man, and you have to understand Rove is the political director at the White House, was deeply involved in targeting and taking out the U.S. attorneys who are recalcitrant and wouldn't start handcuffing Hispanic voters on false voter charges. They also know it's a slippery slope, because they know that I have 500 of the so-called missing emails. And in fact, that's one of the points that in one of their internal emails, which was actually subpoenaed by the committee, they're complaining about that guy, the British reporter. That's Greg Pals. As you realize, Amy, I'm American. But, of course, my reports are exiled to BBC Britain, and then they come back here through Democracy Now!, bless you. But they're saying that these reports about Griffin's role have not been picked up in the U.S. media, in the U.S. national media. And they're kind of right. I mean, this material has not come through the U.S. media. They don't want Griffin roles opened up, because once they have the role of Griffin in the firings opened up, they'll ask why that happened. They will find and discover these emails. And in fact, now that they're public, we'll turn them over to the Conyers Committee. And then they'll find out that Griffin was deeply involved in the removal of legal voters. And now you're getting into potential felony area. That's a very serious business. So they want to stop the slippery slope of bringing in Griffin and revealing the entire chain of emails, not just his involvement in the firings, but what led up to it. And that brings us to the emails that you just saw on our report.
In this whole scandal, we keep hearing about voter fraud. But can you explain what is being talked about here with this aggressive effort to restrict particularly people of color voting in battleground states?
What happened is that the Republican Party was running a massive campaign directed by Karl Rove, and we know Tim Griffin from the written emails, to block voters' votes or to challenge their votes. One way to challenge voters was to say that they were stealing someone else's identity. Someone is voting for Amy Goodman. Well, they say the solution is to create ID cards. The problem is we can't find anyone anywhere who's committed this crime of stealing Amy Goodman's name to vote. People are not willing to go to jail to vote in some school board election or even for the presidency. What Griffin, Rove's assistant, wanted Iglesias to do, they gave them 110 names. They wanted them, for example, to arrest some guy named, say, if I remember, like Juan Gonzalez, and say he voted twice, stealing someone's ID. Well, in New Mexico, there may be two guys named Juan Gonzalez. So Iglesias just thought this was absolute junk stuff, and he wouldn't do it. So it's all about trying to create a hysteria about fraudulent voting. There are 120 million people that voted, and I can't find an actual case out of 120. Of a prosecution a real prosecution of any single voter for voter identity theft. There's like five cases in the country involving some minor offices. That's it. So it's a complete false prosecution setup, kind of like the Soviet Union. Just grab people, put them on show trials. Maybe you let them go later. Maybe they languish in jail. On the other side, they're covering up their own programmatic challenge of voters, which is not covered in the U.S. press. 3 million people were challenged. By the way, this isn't, you know, from the Democracy Now! Black helicopter. This is from the raw data of the United States Election Assistance Commission. 3 million challenges. These votes were basically lost. Over a million votes were lost. 500,000 absentee ballots were thrown out, and many, many of those were votes of African-American and Hispanic soldiers that went to Iraq, got their ballots challenged under this Karl Rove, Tim Griffin scheme, and they lost their vote. And they didn't even know that they lost their vote. So all this is being covered up, and so they cannot now. They don't want to open up the whole story of Tim Griffin and how he became U.S. attorney, what his role was, because it goes all the way back. And what David Iglesias was saying, U.S. attorney, now captain, by the way, he's back in the military, Captain Iglesias was saying, if you can show this chain of intent, that it's all about the voting, and he's being punished for not bringing these false prosecutions, says that's an obstruction of justice charge that can be brought against Karl Rove. And by the way, one little sidelight on that is that Captain Iglesias, one of the excuses that they try to give for firing him, Amy, was that he was absent for too many days from office. They didn't mention that he was absent because he was on active duty in the U.S. Naval Reserve. He is now, by the way, bringing the very first claim ever. You cannot fire someone for doing their duty in the U.S. Naval Reserve. He's now filing a charge against the commander-in-chief, George Bush, for attempting to fire him for simply showing up for active duty.
The Arkansas Leader reported, enterprising reporters examining Griffin's fanciful resume discovered his blistering record as a prosecutor was nothing more than paper shuffling. In short stints in the Army Judge Advocate General's Corps and federal prosecutor offices, he'd never taken a single case to trial. His career had consisted almost altogether of political hatchet work.
Well, you have to look at what's going on here. You've replaced Iglesias, who is, you know, the Tom Cruise lawyer who has real experience as a prosecutor, as a trial lawyer from the military. They remove him and they put in a paper shuffler. Worse, someone who's actually shuffling voters' papers that he shouldn't be shuffling. You saw the kind of emotional reaction of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., voting rights attorney. He was the most emotional because you have to imagine, remember, that his late father was the predecessor to Alberto Gonzalez. Imagine, we've gone from Robert F. Kennedy Sr. to Roberto Gonzalez.
Alberto, right.
Yeah. You know, and you can, you know, from Kennedy's view, that was, this was very an emotional issue. To see the office that his father used to protect civil rights being used deliberately to attack civil rights is a very serious business. But again, here, he's saying, and Iglesias is suggesting now with this evidence, that it rises now to obstruction of justice.
And interestingly, McClatchy newspapers reporting as part of the strategy, the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division has sought to roll back policies to protect minority voting rights on virtually every significant decision affecting election balloting since 2001. The division's voting rights section has come down on the side of Republicans.
Well, even worse, what's not covered there is that they covered up the active attack on legal voters. I mean, you're talking, this caging list that we have in the 500 sheets, the 500 emails, we have 70,000 names. That's one state. This was a multi-million dollar gold-plated attack operation on the right of minority voters to vote. And obviously, Griffin knew it because he was in charge of it. So you actually have the guys who are supposed to be protecting the voters are either actively covering up or even actively participating in knocking out legal voters. I mean, you have it's like the mob has grabbed the police department. That's the problem, by the way, with voter fraud, with real voter fraud, not the phony stuff of grabbing the Juan Gonzalez's of New Mexico. If you win, you've now grabbed the apparatus of protection and enforcement. It's the perfect crime.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Greg Palast, for joining us. Greg, investigative journalist, latest book just out in paperback called Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting in over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at our website, and our headlines are in Spanish and transcript in audio form for any radio station to take around the world. As we turn now to look at the dire situation for women in Iraq and Afghanistan. Earlier this month, the Daily Mail of London published the following dispatch from Iraq. A 17-year-old girl has been stoned to death in Iraq because her boyfriend was from a different religious faith. Dua Khalil Aswad, from a minority Kurdish religious group, Yazidi, was condemned to an honor killing by men in her family and hardliners due to her relationship with a Sunni Muslim. She had taken shelter in the house of a Yazidi tribal leader in Bashika near the northern capital, Mosul. 8 or 9 men stormed the house, dragged Ms. Aswad into the street where they hurled stones at her for half an hour. Reports said a local security force saw the attack, didn't try to stop it. Now her boyfriend is in hiding. Human rights groups say this honor killing is just the latest news to emerge from Iraq that shows how the condition of women in Iraq has rapidly deteriorated since the U.S. occupation began. Some have described it as the Talibanization of Iraq. Today we're joined in Los Angeles by two leading feminists, one from Iraq, one from Afghanistan. Yanar Mohammed is the co-founder of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, The group vocally supports women's rights in Iraq and shelters Iraqi women targeted in honor killings and sectarian violence. She was born in Baghdad in 1960. She left Iraq in 1993, then returned after the U.S. invasion. Dr. Seema Samar also joins us in Los Angeles. She's the chair of the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission and is the United Nations Special Envoy to Darfur, Sudan. She served as Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Women's Affairs in Hamid Karzai's first government following the U.S. invasion of 2001. She was forced to resign her government post following death threats. Both Yanar Mohammed and Dr. Seema Samar are featured in the new issue of Ms. Magazine. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Dr. Seema Samar. First off, you had trouble getting into the United States this weekend?
Good morning, first of all. I think the problem was not really, they didn't try to stop me, but the whole procedure of providing visa was so long, and it took 3 weeks. So I think it was a bureaucratic situation, not really trying to stop me not to travel to the United States.
Can you talk about the situation in Afghanistan today?
Yes, I do. Do you want me to describe what is the situation today?
Yes, please describe.
Well, unfortunately, after 5 years of the fall of the Taliban government, we have not achieved much on human rights on the ground. One of the reasons is that I believe that we cannot bring democracy and human rights through military activities only. So we need a comprehensive program for bringing democracy or promoting democracy in countries like Afghanistan or in Iraq or in other countries. So what has been done so far in Afghanistan, yes, we did achieve something, or a lot. At least we had election, we had constitution. But the reality is that we keep losing the ground to the Taliban and Talibanization in the country since last year. We have active war in some of the areas, and the women's rights situation or the women's situation in the country has not been changed much. Because, yes, we do have equal right in the Constitution, but the reality is the Constitution is not getting implemented or real for the women's in different parts of the country. The women's situation in most big cities has been changed. They have access to education. They have access to work. But not in the rural areas. They still face the same problem as they were facing during Taliban. There is a lot of restriction on women's rights. There is a lot of violence against women, and there's some honor killing in Afghanistan also.
The latest news out of Afghanistan, Mullah Dadullah, a senior lieutenant of Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, killed yesterday in the southern province of Helmand. How significant is this, and what was the response there, Dr. Samar?
Well, I think it was a positive achievement because Mullah Dadullah was one of the hardliner of Taliban commander in the country. But I think killing of one person of the Taliban is not going to change a lot in the country because the people wants to see changes on their life, why the people are supportive of Taliban, why they are getting civilian support. I mean, they are accommodated by the local people because they have not seen any changes on their life after the presidential election and after the parliamentary election. They don't see practically a lot of improvement of their daily life. There's lack of job opportunity. There's lack of access to health care, access to education. All these basic social services are not provided to them. So, yes, a person who was very hardline Taliban and he was commanding, he was the biggest commander of Taliban in the country, but I don't think that will change a lot the situation in the country. So we have to do a lot of work, a comprehensive on the plan for Afghanistan, not only on military activities. It should be a lot of development work, and we should do a lot on accountability and justice and also good governance in the country in order to build the confidence between the government and the public.
Dr. Yanar Mohammed, the situation for women in Iraq right now?
Well, you just said it. Honor killing is becoming something to celebrate in Iraq now, and this did not happen before the last years that we experienced in the post-war Iraq. When a young woman is killed, actually it was more than 8 to 9 males around her. It was hundreds of males standing around. None of them helped, but they were very keen on photographing the scene, on videotaping it on their cell phones, on their mobile phones. And on top of that, the part, the information that's missing in the report is that some of our codes, the penal codes, which is part of our laws, they support the killing of women. And if they are dishonorable, quote-unquote dishonorable. So what happened in this new Iraq, the so-called liberation of Iraq, has turned women into refugees inside their country. Millions of us are vulnerable to be killed, and all our lives are threatened, and there is nobody to secure our lives for us. The policemen were standing and watching, and actually they helped to get the young girl back to the place where she was killed. So by constitution, we have lost our rights. Honor killings are on the rise. Kidnappings of women are getting more now. Our organization's work proves that. Human trafficking is still rising and not much is being done about it. And when you look at the situation, it's as if the country was occupied and later on handed down to the extremists who were responsible of the 9/11. Why are all the TV outlets given to Islamists? Where are the Democrats? Why aren't they being supported? Where are the seculars? Why are the women's groups not being supported? And we are one example of those. It is as if it was a plan to make us weaker, the women, the freedom-loving people of Iraq, and to support the extremists, to give them, to hand the government over to them. And today I hear in the reports that the U.S. Media is very happy that the resistance is are having multiplications and they're not working together anymore. Like, what could be more miserable than this? And a country is occupied, and if there wasn't a well-plan set in place to bring a better situation, are they waiting for the resistance to fall apart? It is such a catastrophe what has happened in Iraq. And still, the alternative is there. The freedom-loving people of Iraq, some of the groups, the women's groups, the labor groups, the youth groups, have never been supported. They are not represented in the parliament. It is there to be supported, and yet we see all the support going to the misogynist groups, to those who are into who have inhumane agenda. And this was the occupation of Iraq. This is what it's about, the Talibanization of Iraq. This is what we have witnessed, and the crime of killing the young girl Doa in the Kurdish part of Iraq, it's just one example of how all Iraqi women are kept under threat. And this is just an example of how all Iraqis now are prisoners inside our own country. You even cannot leave this prison to go to countries like Jordan and other places because they don't let you go through the border. So it's a big dilemma, and there are no answers. So the answer to that from our side, the suggestion is that the U.S. troops should leave immediately, because we, the people of Iraq, do not agree that all the jihadis from around the world are coming to Iraq to fight this so-called U.S. evil. And our cities are turning into an arena of fight, and all our lives are being devastated. The U.S. troops need to leave immediately with no conditions, and we do not accept the debate that there will be a bloodbath afterwards, because nothing is worse than the sectarian war that we are living right now, and that is also a consequence of this war. So honor killings, women have lost their rights, sectarian war, insecurity, and even unable to leave our country to go to a safe place. all of these are happening, and the only answer to that is that the U.S. troops have to leave right away. No conditions to be set here.
Yanar Mohammed, I want to thank you for being with us. We're going to continue our discussion with you, as well as Dr. Seema Samar, chair of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, when we come back from break.
لا نعود يوم على حبكم تايبين لا نمر مرة بدربكم حالفين لا نعود يوم على حبكم غلطة مرت وانتهت شمعة العشرة انطفت غلطة مرت وانتهت شمعة العشرة انطفت والذنب هو ذنبكم والذنب هو ذنبكم تايبين وللمحبة ما يرجع الحنين ما يرجعنا الحنين غلطة ودفعنا ثمنها أجمل أيام السنين.
I'm a Taufik here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Emma Goodman. Our guests are Yanar Mohammed, founder and president of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, and Dr. Seema Samar, chair of Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission and UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Darfur, Sudan. And I want to talk about that in a few minutes. But Dr. Samar, as you hear Yanar Mohammed describe the situation in Iraq for women, how does that compare to Afghanistan?
I think the problem is almost similar to Afghanistan and Iraq. I think one of the problem was that Afghanistan was not a success story. So they tried to apply everything that they have done in Afghanistan to Iraq. And I think the connection between the two countries as a region and also as a Muslim country is very close, because we have learned, our people have been learning the suicide attacks and car bombs and remote control bombs from Iraqis. Actually, so the situation is not much different, but we have a different situation by having the coalition force and also ISAF troops in the country. The coalition forces, mainly the American forces with the British, but the ISAF troop is all the NATO country. So there's unfortunately a lack of coordination between the troops, either if it's American special forces and the NATO forces in different country. So they tried to apply the same policy as they had in Afghanistan to Iraq. And that scene, it's different, because we had the Taliban in the country and there was a kind of legitimacy for invasion in Afghanistan, which is different situation in Iraq. Of course, the violence in Iraq is much, much more and stronger than it is in Afghanistan. But, I mean, the violence and the fighting and insurgency in Afghanistan is also getting more powerful, because at least in 6 or 7 of the western and southwest provinces are very active, and the government keep losing the to control some of the districts in the country. So I think what is happening that they have to, the international community have to look at the situation in Afghanistan and do assessment of their work in the last 5 years and find the weak points and do not repeat the same mistake as they did in the early 80s and 90s in Afghanistan. I'm completely agree with Yanar, because we have same problem in Afghanistan. There's not much support for the progressive groups in the country. It's always try to be support the fundamentalists or the powerful jihadi groups has to be supported by, unfortunately, by the international community, including the U.S.
Explain
that
more, Dr. Seema Samar.
in a position to promote democracy in the country.
Dr. Seema Samar, explain that further, especially the U.S. role here. What jihadi groups do you see that the U.S. shoring up, and what pro-democracy groups do you think should be shored up that are being sidelined?
I think that the jihadi groups, some of the commanders and jihadi leaders has been supported by the U.S. troops when they invaded the country in order to fight against the Taliban. That's the first step. And the secondly, they have been given money and support by the U.S. troops in the country to keep their position. And the third problem, they never speak about accountability and justice in the country. And human rights, respect for human rights. This is very, very important. We cannot speak of democracy and progress in a country without respecting human rights and human dignity in a country, and especially the equality between women and men. I believe that women's right is human right, and everybody believes on that. But this is, in a way, is put aside, and they are not trying to promote that very much because they try to say that we respect the tradition and culture and religion in the country. But we do not have to respect the tradition which oppressed the women, which violate the human rights in the country. And it's going on in the country. And some progressive group, educated one, are not really being supported. We have the example of the impeachment of the Minister of Foreign Affairs in the country, which was not. I mean, the refugees were deported from Iran, and the parliament asked him to answer. It's not his job. He cannot resist against another country who has more power, and there's a different political reason for that to be those refugees to be deported. One of the reasons is that the problem between Iran and U.S., and they want to put a lot of pressure on the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. So he has been impeached, and he has been used or tried to be kicked out of the cabinet. This is, the international community, especially U.S., has to have strong stand on that because he is not a warlord. He is not belong to the extremist political parties in the country, and he has not been supported. So this is the sign. And the parliament brought him and questioned him on the issues that is not related to his job. So having parliament and having the early election in the country, giving chance to some of the warlord and war criminals to come and join, to be part of the parliament, is not helping democracy. Is not the parliament in Afghanistan is not in an institution to promote democracy in the country. So we should not apply the same policy, unfortunately, in Iraq, and they almost did that.
How do you compare the situation, or do you at all, the situation in Afghanistan, where you're chair of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, with the situation in Sudan for women? You're the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Sudan, particularly Darfur.
Yeah. I think there are similarities between Afghanistan and Sudan because we have almost... One similarity that I face and I see it is lack of accountability and justice. And it's same in Afghanistan and it's same in Iraq. There are crimes committed by different people in the country, and none of them has been brought to justice. And none of them has been brought to... The culture of impunity continues in both countries. None of them has been stopped, actually. The culture of impunity has continued in both of the country. On the women's right issue, of course, it's a traditional society. Excuse me. It's a traditional society, both Afghanistan and Sudan. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I hope you can get water. Go ahead.
And I think the woman has been used as a, unfortunately, as especially the sexual violence, as a tool of war in Sudan.
I'm going to go to Yanar Mohammed so you can catch your breath. I would give you some water if I was in the studio with you, but Dr. Seema Samar and Dr. Yanar Mohammed are in a studio in Los Angeles. I'm here in New York City. Yanar Mohammed, when we left off at break, you said the U.S. soldiers have to get out now. So paint a picture for us, if you will. What would happen in Iraq then if the U.S. troops were to leave today?
Well, I'm not saying it's going to be paradise right away, but the idea is that we are having all these jihadis coming to Iraq because there is this magnet, which is the U.S. troops in there. For them, that is the biggest evil, that they are coming to fight. And if these troops leave the country, and all of them leave the country, there isn't much reason to come to Iraq anymore. If you tell me there are already Islamists in power and in the government and in the resistance and there will be fights among them, I tell you, yes, there will be fights among them. But then again, those who are in power are not really, they don't have the popular base that they used to have in the first 2 years. You go to their own areas like Sadr City and the other Shiite parts of Baghdad, you find out that the young people are looking for the seculars, for the progressive groups to join. And then again, you look at the so-called resistance, the Islamic Party of Iraq. They do not have very strong... Now they have strong grounds because they are fighting against the Americans. But if the U.S. troops leave, and we all know that the resistance is a sum up of the old Baaths and some Arab nationalists and Al-Qaeda. So if the U.S. troops leave, even that part of the resistance resistance will lose its popular base, and there will be all sorts of multiplications in there. And you know what, Amy, the only difference between Iraq and Afghanistan, although we spoke much of the similarities, is that in Iraq you had a society, you had all the infrastructure working, you had it was all functioning, and the people had not lived decades in a war-torn situation. So there is a big number of Democrats, of progressives, civil society that could be put together, and it could be mended. But we really need to push on the issue of the U.S. troops leaving right away. There will be some chaos for some time, but because the extremists do not have the strong support from the people that they should have, most of the support came from either surrounding countries or the big powers in the world. The U.S. administration preferred to see moderate, so-called moderate Islamists in power. And what's moderate about somebody who looks at women as less than men, about somebody who thinks that people belonging to other sects of Islam are less of human beings, and about somebody who has no accountability? I think it's not news today when we speak that all the kidnappings in Iraq, most of them at least, are happening by police cars. Many of the public executions against women are happening by, are being administered by the militias who are affiliates of power. So there is no accountability, there is no respect for human rights, and yet they are governing us. The U.S. troops should leave, and they should not impose any political agenda on Iraq, and the support should not be given to the extremists. The people of Iraq are still an integrated society. The youth do not want to see the extremists in power. We will have the dynamics that will make it work, be it by election, be it by the grassroots who will bring about the democratic sense into the country. Yeah, it should work. But the solutions that are being brought by the U.S. administration, be it a security plan, it didn't work. It's a total failure.
Yanar Mohammed, we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you both for being with us. Yanar Mohammed, founder and president of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, and Dr. Seema Samar, chair of Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, both in Los Angeles, both just recently came into the United States. That does it for our show. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike Berkshire, Doug Kadoosh, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.